But how can you compare yourself to other writers' first drafts? You can't, because what you're looking at is other people's very polished, finished product that has been through rounds and rounds and rounds of editing.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential.
Sandy Rodriguez is an author, court interpreter, and former editorial coordinator for the Mexican newspaper Reforma. She landed her first writing job at age 12 and felt inspired to pursue it as a career. In addition to writing her book, Choose to Prevail, Unexpected Insights to Help You Overcome Challenges, Sandy Rodriguez has translated over 20 best-selling books by authors, including Louise Hay and Neil Donald Walsh. She also hosts videos for Encinco and Heart of Hollywood Motion Pictures. Okay, Sandy Rodriguez. I am happy to have Sandy because she is a former newspaper editor, currently working as a court interpreter. She is the author of Choose to Prevail, and she has lots to share on time management and inspiration. So welcome, Sandy. Tell us about how you got on this writing path.
Thank you so much, Ebony. I think that this was something that was just meant to be. When I was a little girl, I was tremendously introverted, and to be honest, I felt more comfortable writing notes or letters to friends, to my parents even. It was just a natural way for me to express myself. And I think people picked up on that because I was only 12 when I was hired. I was living in Mexico City at the time, and I was hired by a magazine here in LA, where I currently live, to be their foreign correspondent. So that was quite exciting because not only did I get a paycheck at that very young age, but I also got to write about very interesting issues. I got to interview and meet a couple of celebrities at the time. So that was obviously very fun. And it was just a fantastic thing. Now, as time passed, I became a little bit better at expressing myself verbally. And the idea of writing everybody notes kind of fell to the wayside. But right out of college, I was hired. I was very, very fortunate to be hired by one of the foremost newspapers in Latin America as their food and fashion co-editor. And over time, I started just moving through the ranks in that newspaper publishing group. The name is Reforma. That is the name of the publishing group. And I spent about 16 years of my life working there. It was very fascinating. And I held a number of positions, including special projects editor, which was very fun because it was a way for me to act as a liaison between different areas in the newspaper and help, let's say, guide journalistically ambitious projects and see them through. And by the time I was, at the height of my career, I was maybe overseeing around 50 different smaller publications put out by the newspaper as part of the newspaper. We call them supplements, and they were like small magazines on topics that were so wide ranging, from female entrepreneurs to the environment, to issues that might be affecting senior citizens, to plastic surgery and beauty in general. So it was a very, very fun time. I was very fascinated by that career path. And it taught me a lot about time management as a writer and how to be very efficient when writing. And I think that might be useful to your audience because I've heard you say many times that self-doubt is something that keeps people from writing. And I believe that that is the case along with time management. And I think we can discuss how to get over those two hurdles in this conversation.
Yeah. So time management is huge because I was talking to another writer the other day, and actually she was a writer. And we were talking about how a lot of writers Well, you'll often hear, especially writers who are not yet established, but aspiring writers, they'll say, I just can't find the time to write. I can't find the time. A lot of people also who really want to be writers really don't set the time to do it, right? And so it's just really, it's interesting because it's like, if you want to be a writer, then you have to write. Like that is what you have to do. So how can we start to incorporate writing into our lives in a time like way so that we actually feel like we're writers?
I think that firstly, and this might sound very unromantic because I think that as writers, we're always waiting for the muse and inspiration to strike and all of that. And that's all well and good. But the reality, as you say, is that to be a writer, you do need to write. Mm-hmm. I think we all know numerous friends that say, oh, I have a book in me. I have this fantastic book idea. But if it's not actually being done, you can't really, really, really say that you're a writer yet. Right. Maybe in the future, but not just yet. Yeah. So in order to actually be able to call yourself a writer and to be a writer, you need to complete whatever project you set your mind to. And I think that one of the best ways to go about it is literally to set deadlines. Really. I know it might sound a little bit, again, unromantic or too practical, especially when dealing with fiction or literature as opposed to nonfiction. In my case, let me be honest, I am more of a fiction writer by a nonfiction writer simply because I have worked in journalism so long. Although I must say that many people might say that journalism has a bit of fiction mixed in. I'm not saying that is not necessarily the case in all associations. But the reality is that you do need to set certain deadlines for yourself. And that can be something as small as saying, I'm going to write, and I'm not even joking, a page a week. And you might say, a page a week? Okay, you'll be done in like 1,000 years. Maybe. But I mean, if you're going to write I don't know, but at least by the 10 years from now, you'll have your book. Whereas if you're just saying, oh, it'll happen someday, I'm just waiting for the muse, it might never come to pass. I mean, obviously, I'm being a little silly by saying a page a week. But if you could commit to maybe completing, what, a page a day, you would probably be done in a year, right?
Right.
And one page a day is not a crazy commitment. Or maybe you might say, okay, I want a certain number of words. Or maybe you don't want to do it in terms of output, but rather in terms of time. Maybe you might say, okay, I commit to sitting down in front of my computer and writing for what, half an hour every day, 10 minutes every day. It doesn't really matter, but you do need to force yourself to do something that you feel is doable in your opinion. That's something very true. There's a saying that is, how do you eat an elephant? Well, you eat an elephant one bite at a time, and that's exactly what you need to do, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just won't happen. Now, I do know, Ebony, because I've heard you say this many times, that self-doubt is often what makes people procrastinate or not move forward with their project.
Yeah.
And I think that ties into this very well, because you might say, well, I tried this. I did sit down in front of my computer for half an hour, but I was not sure where to start. I didn't know if what I was thinking was good enough. I would say that when you write your first draft, you need to set aside any self-doubt, because honestly, nobody's even going to look at this thing except for you. So who cares, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I think that the very best way to go about this is to not even try to write well the first time around.
Yeah.
You just need to do, just put everything that's in your brain onto the page. Just go for it.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter if it's misspelled, poorly written, if there are typos. Now, I have to say that myself, as an editor, as a very experienced editor, it's very hard for me to do that because my natural instinct is to go back line by line and kind of edit the first time around. But that will take up way too much of your time, and you would be better off investing your energy in just moving forward. So I really would say that the first draft is something that you just need to get through as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Now, would you agree with this point of view, Ebony?
Yeah, I do. A lot of things came to mind when you were talking, especially the first draft not being perfect, because I think that a lot of writers don't write because there's this fear of the first draft not being perfect. Like, we have this idea, like, the first time we write anything has to be really good. And I think that probably comes from when you're in school and you have to take like timed essay tests. You kind of have to write a really good essay. Like, that's just one shot you have, right? You only have a time to draft. But writing really is a process. And so there's one exercise that we do in the classroom, I do with my students. It's called free writing. It is just like what you say. It's just getting all this stuff out on paper. You're not concerned with whether or not it's grammatically correct, or even if it makes sense. It's just, I call it mentally vomiting, just to get stuff out. And then you can go back and clean it up.
Oh, absolutely. And there's another thing at play in there. Maybe people, aspiring writers particularly, might assume, I'm doing it wrong. I'm sure every other writer can do it perfectly from the very beginning. Right. I'm sure that they're all fantastic. Surely it's only me that is struggling this way. But let me tell you, as an editor, I actually got to see, in the case of the newspaper, I got to see first drafts. I had a situation where I could see where everybody was as to their writing when they were maybe writing longer pieces, something that was more long form. I could certainly see how things were coming along at each and every stage. And I can tell you that even the best of writers, even the most seasoned journalists, everybody, their first draft is awful. That's just the nature of the thing. Mm-hmm. It's not supposed to be great. So I think that just knowing that's the way it is for everyone takes a lot of the pressure off. I think that maybe if this is your first novel or your first nonfiction book, and then maybe you're comparing yourself to writers, but how can you compare yourself to other writers' first drafts? You can't, because what you're looking at is other people's very polished, finished product that has been through rounds and rounds and rounds of editing, copy editing, proofreading, development, editors. So you cannot really compare your first draft to anything you see, because you don't know what's behind it. You don't see the bare bones. You don't get to see that. So that really should take a lot of the pressure off, knowing that everybody's first draft, it doesn't matter if it's your favorite author, it doesn't matter who it is, right. It was awful. It's just a fact.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. I never even really thought of, like, if you're reading a book or you're comparing yourself to any published author, you're not looking at their first draft. You're looking at, like, probably their 10th draft or whatever, right? So then what, because you talked about how, or you mentioned that a lot of people also are just waiting for this this jolt of inspiration to, like, hit them. How do, I think you'd be really good at answering this too, since you, nonfiction writer, newspaper, come up with ideas on which to write. Because I used to have this problem all the time. Like, I just don't know what to write about. What do I write about? How do you start to generate ideas?
And this is a little bit maybe odd, considering that I said that you don't need to wait for the muse. Here's the thing. You don't need to wait for the muse. The muse just pops in whenever the muse feels like popping in. Right. Sometimes you're taking a shower and you get an idea. Sometimes you're waking up and you get an idea. Sometimes you're out living your life and you get an idea. Well, what do? You write it down, you make a note to yourself, you do a little recording on your phone or whatever, and it's there. It's there. In fact, that's the way it works with journalists, particularly when it's not something that necessarily is breaking news. What do you do is you just go out and you live your life, and suddenly you notice something interesting. For example, if you see that everybody is suddenly, maybe using hands-free phone, you would say, well, that's a phenomenon. That's something I've never seen before. Maybe we can do a piece on that. Or if you notice that now everybody is wearing wide baggy pants as opposed to skinny jeans, well, that's a fashion story right there. And it's something that you notice because you're looking at it. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of being observant, and the muse comes to you. That's definitely a thing. And sometimes you might be writing something. You already are, in the midst of writing something that you want to write, like maybe a book or an article, and you might feel that it's almost finished, but then you walk outside and you see something, or you notice something, or you perceive something, or you remember something, and it's like, oh, that ties in very well with that thing that I was doing, and you can just pop it into your story. So I think that if you're observant, honestly, ideas do come to you, particularly if you kind of get in the habit of noticing things, And there's also something that is interesting, I think, especially about nonfiction, is that whenever we have a theory, we can kind of test it out in the real world. It's something like a bit of an experiment. Maybe I think, okay, I'm going to write a book about, I don't know, how important it is to do a certain thing. And then as I'm doing a little research, it comes to my attention that was not the case at all. So maybe I will have to course correct. So it's quite interesting. Sometimes things do take a little bit of a life of their own. Yeah. And that's quite interesting. But here's the thing. In writing for newspapers and editing for newspapers, I learned something that I brought to my book, I believe. And that is what I think makes my book a little bit different from other books in the same category. There's something that I forgot to mention, Ebony, which was that between the time that I was a newspaper editor and the time that I became a court interpreter, I translated many best-selling books from English to Spanish. When I say many, I'm definitely over 20. So that was several. And they were all best-selling books. I know that to be a fact, because normally big publishers do not commission any kind of translation unless a book is a proven bestseller, and they know for a fact that it will be a bestseller in other languages as well. So as a writer, or at that time as an aspiring book writer, to me this process of translating was very fascinating, because I got to see exactly what they were about. I got to see exactly how they were structured and written. And it was a little odd to me that some were very good and some were, well, maybe not as good as other books that I have read that were not bestsellers. So it's interesting. I think that on occasion it has to do with marketing, to be honest. Sometimes it doesn't. But the ones that I didn't like as much as the ones that I did, I didn't like for one specific reason. When I was in journalism, I had a policy, a personal policy, which was everything that I allowed to be published had to be clear, it had to be concise, it had to be interesting, and it had to be useful. And many of the best-selling books that I translated, of course, not all of them, but some of them, I thought they were maybe interesting, perhaps even useful, and in many cases, well, maybe even clear, but for the most part, they were not concise. They were rambling, they were long, they were overly long, and in many occasions I felt, okay, this would have been a fascinating long form article, but why did it turn into a full length book? That makes no sense. Then I got into doing a little research on that point, and I found out something that many newer writers might not be aware of, which is this: many publishers, both established traditional publishers and even some self-published authors, need a lengthy book. They need a lengthy word count and they need a lengthy page count, because books have a spine, and the spine had better be thick enough for your name to be on it, for the book title to be on it, for it to be very, very easily identified on a bookshelf, particularly if it's going to be sold in actual physical bookstores, because it needs to stand out. And unless you're a super famous author, the book is not going to be shown cover up. It's going to be spine facing the buyer. So it has to be a spine that is thick enough and appealing enough. Now, okay, that's all well and good. I understand that. But I also think that only works. I mean, a book that is packed with filler might have a beautiful spine, but it will only be a bestseller if the author is super famous already, if the author has a crazy large platform already, if the book is massively interesting despite being super long. But I would say that overall, it makes for a difficult situation for writers, because on the one hand, you want a large enough spine, but on the other hand, you really should not fill a book with filler, because that's very uninteresting for a reader. So in my case, when I wrote my own book, I thought, okay, how do I straddle this very complicated issue?
Yeah.
And I came to a compromise. I decided that by design, I would write a shorter book, but not so short that the spine would be invisible. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do a little bit of research on that. And I said, okay, 100 pages is thick enough so that it's visible, but short enough so that people can actually read it. I mean, not everybody has the time or the inclination to read a full book. Many people just skim, and I don't want people skimming my book. I want them to actually read it word by word. Okay, 100 pages is a no excuses situation, so that will be the length that I will limit myself to, is what I decided to do when I wrote mine. Now, my book actually is very wide-ranging despite being slim. It covers many, many, many topics, but there are no filler words. Nothing in that book is there just to add additional paragraphs, nothing. It's something that is very, very, very concise. It's extremely concise. It's very direct. It's very to the point, even though it includes stories. I believe I'm a good storyteller. But it's not a book where you might say, okay, I could easily remove a paragraph and that's fine. No, you can't, because I had limited myself to such a short word count that you really can't. And I think that's why readers have responded well. At this time, I have about 120-something very favorable Amazon book reviews. It's doing very well as to sales, especially considering that I'm an unknown author.
Right.
It's doing well enough that we are actually developing a video series based on the book at this time for launching in the future on a streaming platform. So it's doing, let's say, well enough. Mm-hmm. I did not go into this for its money-making properties. And if I did, that would have been a huge mistake. I only went into this because I wanted to share ideas and to connect with readers. And I think I have been able to achieve that, which I might not have been able to do if I had gone forward with a lengthy, lengthy, lengthy 400-page book. I myself am a passionate reader. I have been from childhood. And even myself, right now, I struggle to find the time or the desire to go through a 400-page book, particularly if it's going to be banging the same point home over and over again. So I think that this was a good compromise.
Okay, so wow, that was, you said a lot there, Sandy. And so I want to go back to, because that's really great advice. So your personal role was, when you were an editor, it had to be clear, concise, interesting, and useful. And I never really I always would tie in the conciseness with clarity. And I think this comes in with your newspaper editor, it sounds like, experience, where you have to have you have to be very economical with your words, right? Because you only have so much space in a newspaper. And so, yeah, I never really occurred to me that concise also meant like not having, like, there are paragraphs that you don't need. There are pages that you don't need, right? It's a filler, as you say. So how does someone objectively, or can someone objectively look at their work and say, what here, like, where's the fat that I can trim, or what is totally unnecessary? Or is that something that we should be asking someone outside to do?
I think that it's a twofold thing. I think that you can see it for yourself, and it's especially easy to see when you place boundaries or constraints. If you say, oh, I can just let my work take on whatever form it wants to take and it can be endlessly long, it would be very hard. I think it would be very hard. There's a saying, it's a quote that people sometimes attribute to Mark Twain. I strongly doubt that he himself said this, but whoever actually coined the phrase, I think it makes sense. The phrase is, I didn't have time to write a short book, so I wrote a long book. Okay. And what that means is that of course it's easy to just keep rambling and writing. And normally first drafts might actually end up being longer than your finished product. Why? Because there will be a lot of fat to trim. There will be a lot of stories that make no sense, and you just have to cut them out of the picture.
Right. So, and Sandy, isn't that good though? I mean, I always believe that having a lot in the beginning, it's better to have too much because it's easier to trim down than to have too little, and then you have to add, right?
Yeah. Oh, completely. That's why you should never worry about first drafts. It doesn't matter. They can be lengthy. They can be rambling. They can be filled with typos. It doesn't really matter. But I do think that once the finished product is completed, it should be, well, I mean, here's the thing. I enjoy reading very, very, very much. It's one of my passions. I love it. So I wouldn't necessarily say I prefer something that is short over a book that is long. That is not exactly what I mean. What I mean is that I don't like filler words. If you have something worth saying, and in order to say what you want to say, you need 10,000 pages, go for it, definitely. Mm-hmm. Right? But that's not always the case. Often it's just that people want it to seem like they've been working or that they need to, you know, that's also something that goes back to when we were in school. Your teacher said, okay, you need to write a 1,000-word essay or whatever. Right. Maybe you honestly didn't know the topic all that well. So you're just trying to add words. You can certainly do that, but that's exactly what you shouldn't try to do when you're writing a book. I think you should be less concerned about how it's going to go. Very fascinating books that I found or a technique that I think should be easy to apply is this. A lot of people that want to become writers right now are bloggers. Mm-hmm. Blogs, at least in my view, they tend to be concise. They're focusing on one issue. Maybe somebody's venting about a specific problem, or they're giving a comment on a specific thing that they saw. And they tend to be just right, because a blogger is not forced to fill pages and pages and pages or have a specific word count. Normally they're concise, they're clear, they're interesting. They tend to be. So I think that something a successful blogger could very easily do is just take a lot of their blogs and turn them into a book. I think that would be very easy because every chapter is self-contained. They're interesting. They probably have like a common thread because they all come from the same author. And I think that would be the wiser way to go about it than to take one blog post and say, I'm going to take this one blog post and turn it into a full-length book, because that just won't work. You will just be ending up adding filler and it will be weird. I would much rather have a book on 50 different subjects that are all concise and neat and interesting than just one thing that is an interesting idea for a blog post or a magazine article turned into a full-length book. And I've seen many situations where that is what seems to have happened. Mm-hmm. That maybe a publisher read a magazine article that they thought was interesting and they gave this person a contract, they gave this person an advance, and then the person just took their small but interesting article and turned it into a long but not all that interesting book. I've seen that happen.
Yeah, that's a really great. I've actually seen a few bloggers. There's one, she was really popular maybe about 10 years ago. I can't think of what her blog was called, but she was one of those, the famous, what they called mommy bloggers. I don't know if they still call them that. But she basically took her blog and the different posts and kind of created a book. Someone I was talking with, another writer the other day, and this was a fabulous idea. I love this idea. But she's writing another book, and she said that she takes some of her essays that she wrote for college and she just kind of repurposes them. She adds a little bit more like personal narrative to the mix for her books. And I thought that's a really great idea, to take your essays and repurpose them. I think that's brilliant. So I think that's a really good idea to take collections of things that are related and then turn that into a book. Then try to take one subject and draw it out. I think that's why collections of essays do really well. Or I like writing books that are collections of essays.
Me too, but that's the exact situation. For example, if you have a book of short stories, for instance, normally they're beautiful, but it would be a very strange thing for the author to say, instead of doing this, what I want to do is I want to take any of these short stories and build on that and turn it into a 10,000 page thing. It might not necessarily work. So you kind of know what you want to do with what you're doing. And let me tell you, you were asking a moment ago whether you yourself would be the one trimming the fat from your initial drafts or whether it would be an editor. I think it would be a bit of both. Obviously, you do need a professional editor, even if you choose to go the self-published route.
Yeah.
At some point, you need somebody else. You need a fresh pair of eyes. Like, for example, I myself am a professional editor, and still, of course, I had to go to a second or a number of other editors because they need to look at it with a fresh set of eyes. Mm-hmm. But there's something that I would recommend to anyone to do before handing it over to anybody else, and also after you have the finished draft at the very end, which is to read it out loud. When you read your own book out loud, even before you hand it over to any other editor, you yourself can say, okay, this makes no sense. And you can just cross that out. Or, no, this is very repetitive. Or this would be, this sounds clunky. Or this sounds, this doesn't make sense. You can just do that. And that is also a good practice once you get everything back from a copy editor or a proofreader or anybody else. Right before you send that over to your final publisher, if you're publishing traditionally, or your printer, if you're self-publishing, read it out loud once again. Of course, by then you've seen this text like 10,000 times and you hate it because you've been just looking at this like for months, right? But it's important for you to read it out loud because that way you can catch any minor typo, you can catch any minor thing, and it's useful. It's quite useful. I think that's a good idea just overall.
Yeah, there's this, I guess maybe it's an app too, but it's a website called Natural Reader where I just cut and paste my work into there. And there was a robot voice that reads it, but they sound like, they have voices actually sound very human and not like this where they're talking on the same pitch. Right. But it's a great idea because especially if I'm getting tired of reading out loud to myself. And sometimes when I read out loud myself, I might overlook something, but, if I hear it from this robot, it makes it a little easier. It just feels good to have another voice, to hear another voice read your work, because it does kind of point out the stuff that that's not really working, right?
Exactly, but it does make a huge difference to when you hear it rather than just read it. That's for certain.
Yeah, you know, and that kind of reminds me that writing. Like I was reading a book. I just purchased this, and I listened to the audiobook. Speaking of listening, listen to the audiobook of this. The author is a famous editor, Sol Stein. Anyways, he wrote this book on writing, and he was talking about how a lot of writers forget that reading is a multi-sensory experience. And so it's important to hit all of the senses, like the imagery, things you can hear, taste, touch, feel, smell, just because it brings the work to life and makes the work a little bit more engaging for the reader. When you were editing, did that play a part, like the imagery, the sensory?
I think so. Here's the thing. My book is a little unusual in that it includes a couple of touches of humor. It's a little bit of it has a little sprinkling of humor, but it also has stories in it that are very, very touching that involve, for example, danger and death and pain. So certainly in those ways, again, when I say that you need to be economical with your words and you need to be clear, I'm not saying remove anything that inspires feelings, that inspires the painting of a picture, but you will be able to see it yourself, particularly when you're reading it out loud or listening to it being read to you. I definitely agree that you need to include words that evoke a feeling. And sometimes it's not only a matter of adding adjectives on, which can be done, of course, but sometimes it's a choice of words. Sometimes, of course, every word has numbers of synonyms, but some synonyms actually sound funny. For example, it's not the same thing to say, I had a lot of work today. Then it was a very grueling experience. It was very draining.
Yeah.
It was very painful. It's not so much that I'm using more words. It's more like I'm using a word that is more deep in its own way.
Yeah.
Or sometimes we fall into the habit of only using words that we are comfortable with. So we say, oh, that's amazing and that's awesome. But we cannot just go around saying, oh, it was an awesome house and this was an amazing thing. We need to bring more color into your language. And sometimes you can get that excitement going, not necessarily by using more words, but rather by using specific words that evoke a little bit more of a feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that's something you do develop over time. The other thing is that you do need to see what cannot be removed. For example, you might say, but okay, so this woman is recommending using as few words as possible. So then I can't mention what something looked like. I can't mention what something sounded like. No, of course you can, but you have to do it in a way that really makes sense to your story. You can't add things on just for filling pages, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I think it definitely happens. The other thing is that many people feel that many book lovers feel that books are superior to movies in many ways because books actually do bring ideas to life and they're supposed to trigger your imagination and to bring all of these amazing visuals and pictures into your mind, even though they're not actually there. And of course, the special effects in your own mind will be something that is greater than anything you can see on a screen. And I think that can be carried out in all situations by the use of language. Certainly that is something that fiction draws upon heavily, and fantasy certainly should. That's of course the nature of what you're trying to achieve. But even in nonfiction, a lot of very effective nonfiction authors, sometimes I read what they've written and I cry because it's very moving, or I laugh because it's just hilarious.
Yeah.
And that's just in the writing technique, that they can actually trigger feelings, definitely. But I don't feel that it's adding words randomly that will create that effect.
I mean, one of my favorite genres of nonfiction to read for its emotional effect are speeches. Because speeches, they do the same thing. I mean, like, they can get an audience just riled up and like ready for war. And it's because they're picking those very concise words that they're emotive, right? They're using emotive language to really get those people ready, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's the situation. And I do think that it comes a lot, it comes down to writing technique and definitely word choice. Like saying something is amazing, again, is never going to be the same thing as saying it's exhilarating or it was such a thrill or it was like, you know, you can kind of like get people excited by the kind of words that you're using, or you can evoke a feeling definitely.
There's an author, oh my gosh, Constance, I can't think of her last name now. Please forgive me, Constance. But she wrote this book, and it's about grammar, but it's written in such a way where it's just so engaging. And she talks about picking the word that has the perfect pitch. She uses a music analogy. And she says, there is a difference between saying that he drank a cup of coffee, or he sipped, or he slurped, or whatever. But it's finding that word that hits the pitch that you're trying to convey, right? And she talks about using a thesaurus to help you out. I found that those students that use the thesauruses, they will go for the most wackiest word just to sound smart. Right? That can be a problem with younger writers, but I think thesauruses really are quite helpful in that. Yeah. Sandy.
Oh, very much so.
Yes. This is, I can't believe we're almost out of time. And I feel like there's so much more we could talk about here. But so I know that, did I read somewhere that you translated a Louise Hayes book?
Yes, I did.
Yes. And in the process of, I don't know how many books like Louise Hayes you've translated or have even read, but did you learn anything from those more like the inspirational books that have helped you in your career or in your, even if your writing style or your time management, or what has inspired you, I guess is my question.
Well, I actually did translate about somewhere between 20 and 30 different books. Not all of them were in that line. Many yeah. were self-help. And of course, all of them from very, very famous authors for the very reason that we were describing, that translations are only made when a book is a proven bookseller. Yeah. I also translated novels, medical books and such. And I think that, of course, everything I come into contact with, of course, it inspires me in some way or it teaches me something new. Absolutely. I think that can be said of everything that I have read. But actually, they inspired me to write my book in a very different way, because I saw, okay, this is what's available. I would like to write something that is different from everything that's available. Not because there's anything bad about the many books that I translated. In fact, they were fabulous, but I thought they already exist. Nobody wants to read a poor man's version of a Louise Hay book. I mean, that's why she's there, right? I mean, she already exists. I want to do something entirely different, something that might be very, very different from other things in its category. So I think that it was useful for me to read and translate a number of self-help books, mostly because I thought that they were good. I thought that they were interesting. I thought that they had a lot of value, but I also thought that's exactly what I don't want to do because they're already there. Why would I do something that is simply a repetition of something that is in existence? So I actually had to think long and hard about what kind of a book will be very different from things that are out there. And I think that I was able to do that.
Okay. And in reading, like the self-help books, when I was in my late 20s, I loved self-help. I guess maybe it's just a rite of passage for young people. I don't know. But, I know that I myself, just in my, confidence, I grew in my confidence from reading a lot of those books, like Deepak Chopra. As a writer, I think I really learn how to step into my power and write something with a clear intention and with purpose, versus just I want to write something and have people read it and praise me, you know, type of thing. Did you learn anything about yourself as a writer from reading some of these books?
I think that's something that's a common thread between many, if not most, self-help books is the understanding that everybody at some point suffers from self-doubt. That is something that seems to be the common thread in all of these books, because normally the authors themselves explain that that is something that they had to grapple with at some point, not as writers, but in general, in life, in public speaking, in relating to others. Mm-hmm. And I think that once you see that that is the normal human experience rather than a flaw of your own, something that is very unique to you, when you see that that's the norm, that everybody has self-doubt, everybody has insecurities. Once you realize that, and it really comes to light when reading self-help books, I think that takes a lot of the pressure off when you're trying to write or to engage in pretty much any other creative pursuit. It takes a lot of the pressure off, I think.
That other people are experiencing what you're experiencing. Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. This has been great, Sandy. Tell us where we can find you.
Well, I'm available to everyone on Instagram. I love to interact on Instagram with people that might read the book. The name of, or the handle for my Instagram is @choosetoprevail. Mm-hmm. Choose to Prevail is the title of the book, which I actually have right here. Mm-hmm. And this is a book that is available everywhere that books are sold online, be it Amazon, be it BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart.com, Target.com, a number of different platforms, pretty much any platform. I'm also available on Facebook. There is a public Facebook group also titled Choose to Prevail. And soon, I think that either in mid-fall, I think we will be launching the Choose to Prevail interview series based on the book. This will be streamed on a streaming platform titled Heart of Hollywood Cinema. It's a brand new streaming platform that will be launched soon enough. So that's another project right there. Yeah.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is. It's fun. I'm really happy that people have been liking the book. Thank you.
Yeah. There's this streaming, I don't know if it's a streaming service. Well, so on Amazon Prime, you know how you can, their channel, it's a channel, that's what it is, that you can subscribe to. There's one, oh my gosh, now I can't even think of it. Everything I need to think of, I can't think of in the moment I need to. But they I subscribe to it, Gaia.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. It sounds like that would be a perfect match for you. I mean, that they have all these, like, I think there's even this one series, it's called Transcendence, where they sit down and, or he sits down, the host, and talks to different people from the, let me see, how do you say this, like self-help industry, from like therapists to healers to doctor, to authors, artists, whatever. And it's fascinating. It just kind of reminded me of that when you were talking about your book. So
it's
a great, channel. Thank you so much, Sandy Rodriguez. This was what wonderful advice from Sandy Rodriguez. I think that my favorite piece of advice was to keep your writing clear and concise, because you don't want all that extra fluff, the extra paragraphs, the extra words, the extra pages. It gets in the way of connecting with the message, connecting with the text. So I hope that you check out her book. Also check out her social media on Instagram and Facebook, because she has so much knowledge and experience with publishing and writing. Also, visit Zazel.com and sign up for my newsletter. You can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Motivation to Write. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ebony Haywood. Thank you so much for tuning in to this week's episode. And I will see you next week when I talk to another fabulous person. Okay, bye-bye.